Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Yud Gimel with Aleph, seven lines down. Just to review where we left off yesterday, the Gemara brought two braitot, Tanya b'misibat ben and Tanya b'misibat bal. The two braitot were dealing with the psukim that are found at the end of Parshat Maseh with regards to Benot Zlafchad. And over there, there are two lavin that are written. The reason why the woman must marry someone from her own shevet is in Pasuk Zayin there, v'lo tisov nachala livnei Yisrael mimateh el mateh. Ki ish benachalat mate avutav yidbeku bnei Israel. And then two psukim later, it says, v'lo tisov nachalat mimate lemate acher, ki ish benachalato yidbeku matot bnei Israel. So you have two lavin that seemingly are repetitive or duplicative in nature. And the question is, what do we do with that? So the way that the Rashbam brought the two braitot down that we saw yesterday, each braita begins with a different pasuk and a different assumption. The first braita begins with the assumption that the second pasuk is speaking about sibat habal. It's the inheritance of the husband of his wife, which would cause the transference of property from one shevet to another shevet. And then the braita is asking, what is the point of the first lav that's written there? And the braita concludes that the first lav is there because of sibat haben, to say that the child inherits his mother, despite the fact that that would cause a change in the shevet. But that's why she must marry within her own shevet, so you don't have that problem. So the first braita starts out with a premise that the second pasuk is speaking about sibat habal, and then trying to determine what the first pasuk is speaking about, and concludes it's sibat haben. The second braita begins just the opposite, and says that the first one is definitely speaking about sibat haben. The latter one, we don't know what it's speaking about, and then the conclusion is that it must be speaking about sibat habal. That was the view of the Rashbam and the girsa that we have in our Gemaras. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam says that he feels that that is not the proper girsa in the Gemara. Brings a number of questions, including the fact that the Gemara calls this Tanya b'sibat ben, Tanya b'sibat bal. And according to the Rashbam, the two braitot are exactly the same, except from which premise they begin. And therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam says that the first braita is similar to the Rashbam, which is that the latter pasuk is speaking about sibat bal, and therefore concludes the first pasuk must be speaking about sibat ben. The second braita, on the other hand, which is Tanya b'sibat habal, begins with the premise that the latter pasuk is b'sibat habal, and that sheds light on the earlier pasuk that it's also about sibat habal. And therefore you have a braitot arguing about whether sibat ben is included in these pasukim or not. The first one saying yes, the second one saying no. The Gemara then concludes, "Dekuli alma mihat mimate lemate acher b'sibat habal akatuv midaber." Everybody agrees that the latter pasuk is speaking about sibat habal. According to the Rashbam, both braitot conclude that, as well as both braitot conclude that the first pasuk is b'sibat haben. That's one of the criticisms of the Rabbeinu Tam, of the pshat of his older brother, the Rashbam, is the fact that the Gemara could have said that the first pasuk being sibat haben is also a common denominator between the braitot, not just the fact that the second pasuk is a common denominator that they both believe that it's speaking about sibat habal. On the other hand, the Rashbam hinted at an answer to that by saying that sibat haben is not really a chiddush. A son is a blood relative to his mother. The fact that he inherits his mother is not such a big chiddush. The fact that a husband inherits his wife, whereby the whole relationship is created through the marriage and not through any blood relationship, that's a big chiddush, and that's what the Gemara is focused on. And then the Gemara asks afterwards, my mashma, how do you know that that's the case? How do you know? Why is everybody so certain that the second pasuk is talking about sibat habal? Now, for the Rabbeinu Tam, that's a question on both braitot, because both braitot begin with the premise that the latter pasuk is speaking about sibat habal. The question is, what is the implication of that? According to the first braitot, the implication is that the other pasuk must be speaking about sibat haben, whereas in the second braitot, or the latter braitot, for the Rabbeinu Tam, it sheds light on the first pasuk to say it's also talking about sibat habal. For the Rashbam, as he makes a quick change about who the Gemara is speaking about, says over here, be my mashma letanakama kobayle. It's only asking on the first braita, because the first braita took it for a given that the second pasuk was b'sibat habal. The latter braita was had a safek, and then determined it based on the first pasuk. But then that's in the order of the chidush. The first pasuk is talking about the ben, which is a lesser chidush. The second one's the bal. So I understand why they did it. The first braita, which started with the premise that the second pasuk is sibat habal, my mashma, how do they know that? So according to Rabbeinu Tam, it's a question on both braita. According to the Rashbam, it's a question on the first braita. Siman amar rabba bar Rav Shila. So over here, the word siman is not clear what it's doing here. You can see in the Masorah Dashas that Shilu Shem Amora. He says that siman or simon, who is found in the Midrashim and many Mamrei Chazal, was an amorot that is being quoted over here. On the other hand, others say that it was a misplaced word, and siman is like you find in many places in Shas, where they lay out simanim for the upcoming Gemara. The only problem here is that there's a siman without the simanim that are coming up. So that's what leads to the confusion over here. So some say it should be taken out of the text. Others, like Masoret HaShas, say it's speaking about an amora named siman. So siman amar rabba barav shila amar kura, the pasuk says, ish. Pasuk says that an ish references to a man, references to a bow, not to a yeled or to a son that comes from his mother. As the Rashbam notes that the pasuk in Rut says, kamo ish na'ami. So you see there that the term ish is used in the context of a bow of a husband, and therefore the word ish in this context also means a husband. That you also can say, like we mentioned before, that ish means someone of age. And that's usually referring to someone who could get married. A bno or a ben could be even someone who's underage. They're not necessarily an ish. Now, of course, a ben could be an ish, but by defining them as an ish, that for sure means that they are of age, and that's not always the case by a ben, and that's why they said it's speaking about sibat abal. And that is in the pasuk, it says, lo tisov nachala mimateh lemateh acher, ki ish benachalato yidbeku matot bnei Israel. So the word ish is indicative of that pasuk speaking about a baal and not a ben. The Gemara says right away, wait a minute, Tarvayu ish kedivbu. Both psukim have the word ish in it. Even the first pasuk says, "V'lo tisov nachala livnei Yisrael mimateh el mateh, ki ish benachalat mateh avutav yidbeku bnei Yisrael." So ish is also mentioned in the first pasuk. So what are you talking about, that the second pasuk must be speaking about the baal because of the word ish? El amar of Nachum bar Yitzchak amar kra yidbeku. The word davak has implications of marriage, as we know from Sefer Breishit by Adam and Chava. The Torah says there, "V'davak b'ishto," and from that the Rashbam concludes, "Ein lashon davak or devek ela ben ish liisha." That's a reference to a connection between parties. And since it's so explicit that the word dveka or dibuk references to a husband-wife relationship, then that's what it must mean in the pasuk. And therefore the latter pasuk says, "V'lo tisov nachala mimateh lemateh acher ki ish benachlato yidbiku matot bnei Yisrael." And again here, the Gemara says, what are you talking about? Tarvayu yidbeku k'tivbo. The first pasuk also has the word yidbeku. V'lo tisov nachalat b'nei Yisrael mimateh amateh ki ish benachalat mateh avutav yidbeku b'nei Yisrael. And so the word davak is also mentioned in the first pasuk, and that would be implying that the first pasuk was also speaking about the baal v'isha. Now, the give and take in the Gemara is so strange, because the answers that are being given, that ish or yidbiku are the source of the fact that the latter pasuk is speaking about the baal, it's so obvious that the previous pasuk also has these words in it. So then what's the nature of the answer? And the question is so obvious, then how could the person beforehand give an answer in that light? So the Baalei HaTosafot say something amazing over here, and they say, pe'amim shelo hayu biki'im bepsukim. There are times that we find that the Amoraim were not so biki'im in the psukim of the Torah, and sometimes they would mention something and it'd be so obvious that they should have known, yet they don't know it. Although Tosafot then goes on to say, miu hachatema, over here it's a little more surprising. I would say it's more surprising because you're talking about two psukim very close together in the Torah itself, not even in Navi or Ketuvim. Seems very strange. And then he says, ubekuntris perish yafeh, that the Rashbam had a good explanation of it. And here the Rashbam asks the similar question. He asks, how could it be possible that they're making such a mistake? You're caught, in a sense, in a catch-22, which is that if the questioner's question is so good, then what was the person who proposed the answer thinking? If we stretch thin the side that the proposed solution to the problem is much better, then you have a question on the person who questioned it, because why would he question it if it's such a good answer? So you have to strengthen the proposition enough that it makes sense, but not strong enough that they can't be a question on it. And this is what the Rashbam says. Umiyu gama mitaretza yodea d'bahai kray ish k'tiv. The answerer who says that there's ish in the second pasuk also knew that there was ish in the first pasuk, d'zil karibi ravu. It's something that you learn in nursery school. It's something that you learn when you go to cheder. You don't need to be a genius to know that there's ish in both psukim. So in the end, what the Rashbam says is that what the answerer was saying is that the first pasuk is extraneous, and therefore we use it for sibata ben. The second pasuk has the word ish in it, and that is also extraneous, so we're going to be doresh something from that word ish. Now, what about the ish in the first pasuk? The person who gave the answer says there's some drusha that they have for that word ish in the first pasuk. So in essence, what he was proposing is that we have two psukim here. There definitely is an extraneous pasuk, An extraneous pasuk, we're going to say it's speaking about the Sibata Ben. So then why do you say that the second pasuk is speaking about Sibata Bao? That's because of the word Ish. Now, he knows that there's also a word Ish in the first pasuk, but he says there's some other drasha with that word Ish. Well, if there's another word drasha with that word Ish, then what is the questioner saying when he says to him, well, there's Ish in both pasukim? He already addressed that by saying that the first Ish is the drasha. The second Ish is now available to teach us that that pasuk speaking about Sibata Bao. So then the questioner comes back and says, how do you know which way is which? Adraba, kama lugufei, the Sibata Bao, ubatur the drasha. How do you know that the first Ish comes for that drasha, and the second Ish comes to tell you that it's speaking about Sibata Bao? Why don't you say just the opposite, that the first Ish is coming to tell you about Sibata Bao, and the second Ish will be used for that drasha? So the answer was that this Ish is available for a drasha, because the first Ish was already taken up. The questioner comes back and says, how do you know which is the Ish that is the Dafka, making it Sibata Bao? How do you know which Ish is available for this other drasha? And that's the nature of the question. And similarly, in the next case of Yidbiku, he's doing the same thing. The first Yidbiku is used from some other drasha. The second Yidbiku comes to teach you about Bao V'isha or Sibata Bao. And again, the questioner says, wait a minute, how do you know the first one is for the drasha, the second one to teach you about Sibata Bao? Say the reverse. The first one is for Sibata Bao, and the second one is for that alternate drasha. So that's the nature of the back and forth according to the Rashbam. It's still a little bit problematic, but at least it gives some substance to the nature of the answer that's given without making it obvious as to what the question is going to be on that answer. El Amar Rova, so now Rova proposes a third possibility as to why the latter pasuk is speaking about Sibata Bao, because Amakra, Yidbiku Matot. In the latter pasuk, after the word Yidbiku, it uses the word Matot. Says Lo Tisov Nachalam Mimatel Matacher Ki Ish Benachlato Yidbiku Matot Bnei Israel, which is not true in the first pasuk, because in the first pasuk it ends Ki Ish Benachlat Mateavutav Yidbiku Bnei Israel. The word Matot is not found there, and as the Rashbam points out, the only way to have Dveikot Matot, the only way to have a joining of Shvatim, is through marriage, is by a Bao, and therefore Yidbiku Matot, which we then will say is referring to Bao V'Isha Matot, through the combination of two different shvatim, that's something that can be facilitated by the marriage of a husband and wife. And that's how then we know it's speaking about Sibata Bao. Ravashi Amar, and now we have an alternate answer given by Ravashi, which is Amar Kra, Mlimate Lamate Acher, from one shevet to another shevet. Uben Lav Acher Hu. The son is never considered to be an outsider. Now we already saw this with regards to Ste Achuzah, where if it's redeemed by an Acher, by an outside party, there, the Gemara already determined that the ben, the son, is not considered to be an acher. But here, even more so, the Rashbam adds the point that when it comes to a son, d'yoresh karei d'imehu, an inheritor, a child, is like an extension of his mother. He is like ubar yerechimo, that expression that we have by a fetus. We say the same thing with regards to yoresh, an inheritor is karei d'imehu. It's as if he's an extension of his mother. And therefore, when you say mimate, lemate acher, to another Shevet, to someone who's an outsider, that can only be true in a relationship of a husband and a wife, because there you're really talking about Shvatim and outsiders. A husband, in essence, is a rachok. He's not a natural relative. He's not someone as a blood relative. On the other hand, the son is a blood relative, and that's why Mateh Acher must be referencing to the husband, the Sibat HaBao, and not to the Sibat HaBen. And therefore, either according to the answer that Rava gave, where we have Yidbiku Matot, or according to the answer that Ravashi gave, which is Mamateh, the Mateh Acher, that's how we know that the latter pasuk is speaking about Sibat HaBao. And therefore, the Braitot then, according to the Rashbam, both believe the first pasuk is speaking about Sibat HaBen. According to the Rabbeinu Tam, the first Braitot believes that the first pasuk is about Sibat HaBen. And the second Braitot believes, just like the second pasuk is like Sibat HaBao, so too the first pasuk is speaking about Sibat HaBao as well. Now the Gemara jumps tracks a little bit and starts to talk about, once we know that the husband inherits his wife, what is the nature of that inheritance? What rights does he have? So Amar Rabbi Bo, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Rabbi Yanai, Amar Rabbi, Umato Ba Mishmei de Rabbi Yeshua Ben Karcha, and they say, or they lean towards saying that it was in the name of Rabbi Yeshua Ben Karcha, Minayin the Baal, She'enu Notel Biraui Kemuchzak. How do we know that a husband does not take in items that are on the come versus things that are already in place? So we're going to go through what this means in a second. I'm just going to take a slight digression because the Baalei Tosafot over here do this. They do it in a couple other places in Shas. They discuss this individual called Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. The reason being that the Gemara in Shavuot tells us that Rabbi Akiva had a son named Rabbi Yoshua. And over here, the Ri speculates that Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha was actually the son of Rabbi Akiva. Omer Ri, de Karchahu Rabbi Akiva, Shayake Reach. That Rabbi Akiva was bald, then Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha was the son of the bald one, the son of Rabbi Akiva. And that Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha was actually Rabbi Akiva's son, the Rabbi Yoshua that is mentioned in the Gemara in Shavuot. And he proves this from a statement of Ben Azai, who is a peer of Rabbi Akiva, where Ben Azai says, Kol chachmei Yisrael domim lefnai kiblat ha-shum, chutz min ha-kereach hazeh. All the other chachamim of Klal Yisrael are like the thin skin of a garlic, meaning that they're nothing, chutz min ha-kereach hazeh, with the exception of this bald one, and there he's referencing to Rabbi Akiva. So you see that Rabbi Akiva was referenced as kereach or karcha, and based on that, the Ri concludes that Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha was actually the son of Rabbi Akiva. The Rabbeinu Tam rejects this for two reasons. First of all, Ben Azai, who was saying it in a light manner and was saying it in a joking manner, is also a peer of his. Maybe he could call Rabbi Akiva Kereach Hazeh. But someone who is talking in a respectful manner or speaking about Rabbi Yoshua ben Rabbi Akiva would never say Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha. And he goes on to prove that the word Kereach or speaking about someone as a Kereach is generally a negative term or making fun of them. And he brings evidence from the Pasuk by Elisha when he leaves Yericho and the children are saying or making fun of him, Elei Kereach. They're making fun of Elisha. And he brings other examples throughout Shas where Kereach is used in a negative form. And therefore he says it's untenable that they would call him Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha if he was really the son of Rabbi Akiva. And then he goes on to bring an incident with Rabbi that also seems to indicate in terms of the ages of the individuals that it wouldn't be possible that Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha was the son of Rabbi Akiva. So just a sidebar here about the individual Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, who the Ri claims was the son of Rabbi Akiva. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam rejects that assumption. Now going back to the Gemara itself, how do we know that the Baal does not get Ra'uy like Muchzak? The difference between them being whether the wife that he's going to inherit is already in possession of the object or not. For instance, if the wife is the only inheritor of her parents, when her parents pass away, she will inherit her father's property or mother's property, whatever they have, she will inherit because she's the sole inheritor of their property. In that case, if her parents predecease her, she will be in possession of that property. And when she predeceases her husband, the property will pass to her husband because she's already muhzak. She's already in control and possession of the property. On the other hand, what's called ra'uy, and we've spoken about this before, that even after someone passes away, the Yerusha moves to that individual, even bekever, even if they're already buried, even if they've already passed away, and then passes down to their closest of kin afterwards. So in a situation where the woman predeceases her parents, and then the Baal would inherit anything that comes to his wife, after the in-laws pass away, the parents of his wife pass away, now the property should have come to his wife. That's what's called ra'uy, because after the death of his wife, she is still entitled to inherit that which is coming from her parents. The question is, does the husband inherit that which comes to his wife after the death of his wife? That's called ra'uy. The statement here is that the Baal does not get ra'uy, only gets muhzak. In that situation where the wife predeceases her parents or whoever she is inheriting, in that situation, the Yerusha will not pass to the husband, rather to her son. It'll go directly down to her son. It'll skip over the husband. And that's what it means over here. Minayin the Baal she'inu tel b'ra'uy k'muhzak. Shenemar, they bring the psukim that we are familiar with before from Divrei Yamim and Yoshua with regards to Skuv, Yair, and Elazar and Pinchas. Shenemar, Uskuv olid et Yair. Skuv gave birth to Yair, v'ilo 23 arim be'eretz ha-gilad. And he has 23 cities in Eretz ha-gilad. Minayin li-Yair shelo ayalo l'Skuv. How does Yair come into possession of property that Skuv didn't have? Meaning that he should be inheriting from his father. How does he come into possession of property that his father didn't have? In Melamaleid, Shenasa Skuv Isha Umeita, that Skuv married a woman and she passed away b'chayei morisha, while the people that were going to pass inheritance to her were still alive. So an example that we gave before, Skuv's wife passed away before her parents passed away, and she was going to inherit from her parents or whoever else she might have inherited from. Umeitu morisha, and then after her death, those people that were going to pass the Yerusha to her passed away. V'yasha Yair. And they went directly down to Yair, the son of Skuv's wife, not to Skuv. So you see from this that Skul was unable to inherit his wife if the property was not in her possession at the time of death. It's only in a case where she's already in possession of the property would be entitled to it. So instead of going to Skul, it skips over Skul and goes directly to his son, Yair. So that's the way that the Gemara explains. That's the way the Gemara brings a proof to that fact. Ve'omer. In addition to that, we have that pasuk at the end of Yoshua, which says, Ve'elazar ben Aaron mate, ve'yikberu. And they buried him be Givat Pinchas Bino, in the area or the fields of Pinchas' son. Minayin le Pinchas, shlo yalo le Elazar. Again, how did Pinchas come into possession of property that Elazar didn't have? Ma'amed shenasa Elazar isha umeita b'chayei morisha. Must be that Elazar married a woman who passed away or predeceased those that were going to pass any property to her. She received the inheritance after she already had passed away. And then afterwards, those that were passing the inheritance to Elazar's wife, they passed away, and now the inheritance passed to Elazar's wife while she was in the kever, and her son Pinchas inherited it rather than her husband. So then Elazar, who is the primary inheritor of his wife, at this point can't inherit from her because he's only ra'oi. It was in her possession when she passed away. Now that it comes into possession when she's in the kever, it passes to her son Pinchas, instead of to her husband, Elazar. So the Gemara here brings those two stories as proof of the fact that it must be that the Baal only has a right of inheritance over here when it's already in his wife's possession. But if it comes into his wife's possession afterwards, then that's not the case. Umay ve'omer. Why do you have to bring two cases over here to prove the same thing? It's very similar to what we saw in the previous Gemara when the Gemara was trying to prove from that about Sibata Baal. Over there, the Gemara was rejecting Sibata Baal and saying that it was really Sibata Ben. Over here, the Gemara is going the opposite direction and saying it is Sibata Baal, but even when it is Sibata Baal, the Baal is not entitled to it necessarily. Maybe the case is a case where Yair married a woman who passed away, and he inherited her. So there you could say, or you could come up with a situation in which the property ended up in Yair's possession without going through Skuv if it was through Yair's wife. And similarly, you probably could say the same thing by Pinchas. If Pinchas' wife passed away, he might have inherited her versus coming through Elazar. So you have a way to have the inheritance reach the next generation without coming to the conclusion that you came to, that the husband does not inherit Beroi when it comes to inheritance of the wife. So the Gemara says, well, if you can explain that case by Skuv and Yair that way, so that's why I have Ve'omer. The additional pasuk to tell you, Talmud Lomar ve'Elazar ben Aaron mate, and then you have the pasuk by Pinchas and Elazar to show you that, no, there's another case like this. V'chiteima, wait a minute. How do you know that in that case, it was the case that the property came into Pinchas' possession in that manner? Now, you could argue, we don't want a duplication like we said before. The Navi is not going to have its way to tell you the same thing twice. So obviously, it's not the same case as Skuf. So it can't be a case where the wife passed away and then only afterwards the property came into her possession that was passed down to her son. No, we're going to say the case is where the son married and then the wife passed away and that's how he came into possession of the property. So you're not going to say the exact same thing by Pinchas and Elazar, but as we mentioned in yesterday's daf, there's still another possibility of how Pinchas came into possession of the property, which is v'chiteima d'nafalei b'stei charamim. Possible that Pinchas came into possession of the property through a stei charam, like we discussed yesterday, whether that's someone who's makdish the cherem stam, which the Gemara in Archim argues whether stam cheremim l'ashem or stam cherem l'kohanim, or for certain if he says cherem l'kohanim, it will go to the kohanim. The Rashbam entertained the possibility that it was somebody who was makdish their steach huzan, did not redeem it before the yovel, and it was distributed to the kohanim. We said yesterday that the Ramban rejected that because there was no yovel in time for the death of Elazar. The yovel only happened afterwards, and there could not be relevant to this situation. But maybe that's how he came into possession of the property. Amar Kra, Bino. The Pasuk says, Bino, Nachala, Haruyalo, Ve'yarsha Bino. So the Pasuk says, Elazar ben Aaron mate, Vikriyoto, Bigvat Pinchas, Bino. Asheni Tan Lo, Behar Ephraim. Bino is extraneous. Now, the Rishonim take different approaches to hear exactly what is extraneous. If you look in the Rashbam, he says, Asher Nitan Lo, Behar Ephraim is actually the extraneous language over here. And that is because, why did it go to Pinchas Beno? The explanation for why it went to Pinchas the son is because Asher Nitan Lo Behar Ephraim. It was given to him in Har Ephraim. Why was it given to him in Har Ephraim? Because Elazar and Pinchas went to a Beit Din to determine who was the rightful inheritor of the property. Elazar's wife had passed away, and now the property had come into their possession after the passing of Elazar's wife. So Pinchas and Elazar went to court to find out who is the inheritor of that property, or who is now in possession of that property. And the Beit Din decided that it went to Pinchas Beno, Asher nitan lo be'ar Ephraim, and they gave it to him. They paskin that it belonged to Pinchas and not to Elazar, because the husband does not inherit biro'oi kimukzak. Now, he brings an alternate way to learn it from the Pasuk, and he says, Rabbeinu Chananel perish, de'kinan mi'ktiv b'haikra b'no. That he learns it out of the word b'no in that Pasuk, which is extraneous. Of course, Pinchas is the son of Elazar. So what does it mean? Ve'kriyoto b'kivat Pinchas b'no? It is something that came into his possession because he was the ben. It was only because he was the ben that he got it, and not because of Elazar, or Elazar was taken away from the property because he wasn't the ben. And therefore, the focus is on the word b'no, and not on Asher nitan lo b'har Ephraim, according to the Rabbeinu Chananel. And for both of those reasons, we have to say that the reason it came into his possession is because he was a ben, or it was given to him by the Beit Din, and not because it came to him through Estei Charamim. And therefore, the conclusion of the Gemara is, a husband only inherits his wife, b'muchzak, what she's in possession of at the time of her passing. Anything that comes into her possession after her passing goes directly to the son of that woman, and not to the husband of that woman. The Balei Tosafot, based on that conclusion of the Gemara, say, there's a little bit of a problem here. We said before that the husband takes precedence over all of the other Yorshim, and that if the wife passes away, he's the first in line to inherit, and then only afterwards do we go through the regular line of inheritance, and the son is behind that husband. But over here you see that the son has more power than the husband. The son gets the property even b'ro'oi, not just b'muchzak. So the Balei Tosafot say, based on that, how do you know that the husband should go before the son? Given that the son has more rights to his mother's property, it would seem that the son should take precedence over the father. So the Balei Tosafot answer, v'yesh lamar, kevin she'baal eino yoresh machmat kurva. The baal does not inherit because he's a relative. Ela machmat she'erot. But he inherits because of the fact that he is a she'er. She'hem chashuvin kebasar echad. They are considered to be one entity. Ishto kegufo. The inheritance of the husband is not because he is a relative, but rather because he is his wife. And therefore, he takes precedence over everyone else because it's as if the property doesn't move from the possession of his wife when it goes to the Baal. But that's only true when you're talking about Muchzak. While she's alive and they're married, then any property that she already owns, then it doesn't leave their possession. It's almost like today where you have joint ownership over something. If one of the spouses passes away, then the property automatically shifts to the other spouse. There's no event because they both owned it. And similarly over here, if the wife already owned the property and it's technically in both of their names. It's in her name, but it will be in her husband's name because they are basar echad. Then when she passes away, the husband gets it right away because nothing changed. It's as if he continued the ownership that he had before. But other things that are bro'oi, after the passing of his wife, then you can no longer claim that they're basar echad because she's not alive anymore. In that instance, then we look at who is the most appropriate or closest of kin to inherit her. That will not be the husband anymore. That will be the son, and that's the order of the parshia, that the son is the closest relative to anybody who is passing away. And therefore, that will explain why b'muchzak, the husband, takes precedence, b'bro'oi, the ben, takes precedence. Because in the case of muchzak, just like the husband takes precedence over all the other krovim, he'll also take precedence over the son, because the nature of his relationship is one of b'yud basar echad, and not one of kirva. And now the Gemara continues to explain the Mishnah, and it says, b'nei achot, which is the girsa of the Reshbam. We also have the alternate gish that we saw in the Mishnah, which is Bnei Achayot, but we're talking about a nephew here that is inheriting. Tana, Bnei Achot, Velo Benot Achot. The children of the sister, the sons of the sister inherit, Velo Benot Achot, and not the daughters of the sister. Ma'ai Hilchata, what are you teaching us? Am Rav Sheshet L'Kadem. It's telling you precedence. It's not the fact that the daughters do not inherit at all, but rather that the sons take precedence over the daughters. So in a case where the brother, their uncle, has no inheritors, the possessions of the uncle will pass to his sister. If his sister is no longer alive, it will pass to the children of his sister. The children of his sister can include sons and daughters. If they're only sons, clearly the sons will inherit. If they're only daughters, the daughters will inherit. What happens if there are sons and daughters? That's the halacha that is being said over here. And by this Tana, Bnei Achot Velo Benot Achot is telling you that the sons of the sister take precedence over the daughters of the sisters, and the daughters will not get anything in that case. Tani Rav Shmuel Bar Rav Yitzchak Amed Rav Huna V'Yarash Mekesh Yerusha Shnia L'Yerusha Rishona. What is the source for the fact that the sons take precedence over the daughters, even though we're not talking about literally sons and daughters, but talking about relatives that are inheriting that are further away from the core individual that has passed away? So we know by Ben and Bat that we had already in the Psukim, and we learned before, that the ben takes precedence over the bat, that the ben goes first, and if there are no banim, then the banot get it, like what happened with banot slavchad. But how do we know that that same din applies in other places? So we learn it now from Ve'yirash Ota. Now, the Baal Yatosvot already asked, wait a minute, don't we need the word Ve'yirash Ota? We just learned from that about the Yerushat HaBaal. So the Rashbam over here says that the limud is not from the Ve'yirash Ota, but rather from the Vav. Ve'yirash Ota, that Vav is Mosif al Inyan Rishon. It tells you that which was said prior also applies down here to the lower down in the echelons of the Yerushat. So he says it's not a stira between what we learned before from Ve'yirash Ota and now this, because it's learned out of the Vav. And in that way, we learn that just like the Yerusha Rishona, according to the Rashbam, that refers to the son and daughter of the deceased. Just like in that Yerusha Rishona, we learned that the son precedes the daughter. So too, be Yerusha Shnia, the next level of Yerusha, which are the brothers. It says if there are no children, and it goes to the brothers. So too, in that level of Yerusha, the sons go before the daughters. So that's what the Rashbam views as Yerusha Rishona and Yerusha Shnia. And then he says, V'chein Kulam. And all of them, B'vav Mosif al Inyan Rishon. Because the entire Parsha is written with a Vav. It says, V'im Ein Lo Bat, V'im Ein Lo Achim, V'im Ein Achim, V'yirash Ota. So the Vav in each of these situations adds on and says that the same din that applied by the Ben and the Bat applies to every situation afterwards. And that's how the Rashbam explains Yerusha Rishona and Yerusha Shnia. On the other hand, the Tosafot don't like this view of the Rashbam about what's Yerusha Rishona and Yerusha Shnia. Rather, they explain Yerusha Rishona as anything that's written in the Torah explicitly. So Yerusha Rishona is anything that's found in that Parshia of the Torah. Those are all Yerusha Rishona, where the ben or the male goes before the female. Yerusha Shnia is a one derivative away from someone who's found in that list. So ben and bat are Yerusha Rishona. Yerusha Shnia would be ben a ben and Bata Ben, or Ben Abat and Bata Bat. Those would be the Yerusha Shnia, because those are the next generation, the first derivative away from those individuals who are mentioned in the Psukim. And that's how the Baal Yatosafot see that Yerusha Rishona and Yerusha Shnia. And the Rashbam concludes from what we're learning here, V'adin Asirit. That is true of anywhere, all the way through the generations, no matter how far you away from the core individual who passed away, the Ben called him the Bat, that the son always goes before the daughter. Dachim kodim lachot, and the brothers always go before the sister. V'achot ha'av kodemet l'bnei achei ha'av, and the sister of the father goes before the sons of achei ha'av. Aval im yesh shnei achei ha'av, if there are two brothers of the father, ulezeh banim ulezeh banot, one of them has sons and one of them has daughters. Elu yoshim chelek aviyem ve'elu yoshot chelek aviyem v'chein halacha. Each one of them then is entitled to the property of their father, not distinguishing between the sons and daughters, because the Yerusha is coming through the brothers, and on that they're in an equal plane. V'chein halacha, and that's what the Rashbam concludes, this is the halacha. The Baal Yatosafot point out that the Rashbam in Churfei, in his sharpness, went through halacha that's not necessarily true. But he says that, V'alchot ha'av kodolt l'bnei achei ha'av, that the sister of the father takes precedence over the sons of the brother of the father. If the brother of the father already passed away, and the sister of the father, the aunt, is still alive, the aunt would take precedence over the children of the father. The Baal Yatosafot said that's just not true. We know from the upcoming Gemarot that whenever it comes to a situation in which children are alive, the children represent or step into the shoes of their parent, based on the principle of Kol HaKodem LaNachala Yotzei Yerecho Kodmim. And therefore, when you have individuals who are the children of the uncle, they will step into the shoes of the uncle, and they will take precedence over the aunt. And therefore, he says that which the Rashbam concludes over here, that the children of the uncle would be subordinated to the aunt, that is not true, because the children of the uncle come with the claim of the uncle, and therefore they would take precedence over the aunt. So that's the only thing that he may hear with regards to what the Rashbam said. But over here, you have a general principle about the male inheritors always taking precedence over the female inheritors. Kaitane Rabba Barchanina Kamed Rabbi Yochanan. Vaya Bayoman Chilo et Banav. Over there, it says in Parshat Kiteitse, with regards to the Yerusha being given to the Bechor. The Bechor is another area which we'll get into at some point about where a Bechor gets a double portion from the father. But there too, just like the husband, he only gets it b'mukzak and not b'ra'oi. Although the definition of mukzak and ra'oi over there are different than it is by the husband, Nevertheless, there is a similar type of halacha. That's just as an aside. But over here you have an instruction in the Torah that says, "Biyom anchilo et banav. Biyom ata mapil nachalot. Viata mapil nachalot balayla." That you only have nachalot that pass during the day, but they don't pass at night. Amar la Abaye, Abaye says, what are you talking about? Elimiata deshchib biyomama hu diyarti lei banei. So that only when a person passes away during the day do his children inherit him. Ma deshochib bilelia lo yarti lei banei. And then someone who passes away at night, his children do not inherit him? That seems ludicrous. Dilma din nachalot ka'amart. Maybe you meant the din nachalot, not that nachala itself only passes during the day and not at night, but a din that revolves around nachalot that can only be done during the day and not at night. Titanya, we have a braita, vaita levnei Yisrael duchukat mishpat. It says about the parshia here of nachala, the final pasuk says, v'im ein achim laviv unatatem nachalotot l'sheiro akrov elav mishpachto v'yarashuta. And therefore it says about that the drusha is ora kol parsha kulali o din. From this you see that the entire parsha is revolving around a din, or that the passing of nachalot is equated with din. And as the Rashbam points out over here, you need both psukim. You need biyom anchilo to teach you that it's only during the day, but that would have been limited to a son, because there it's talking about a bechor inheriting his father. So here, the Torah extends that and says that all nachalot have a din of mishpat. And now that we know that nachalot and mishpat are during the day, so too this applies to any type of yerusha, that the din must be done during the day. Now, what din are we speaking about? According to the Rashbam, the din that we're speaking about here is a din of being mechalet, distributing the property of the nachala. And that when we do that distribution of property, it's not like a shutafut. It's not like a partnership where we dissolve the partnership and then the partners take whatever it is, or they split up the property and they disappear. Nachalot are not that way. You can't just dissolve, quote unquote, the estate, and then each of the partners, the inheritors, goes ahead and walks off with whatever it is. But rather, the din nachalot means that it is a din. It has to be done by a formal beit din, and the distribution of the nachalot must be done in that formal fashion in a beit din. And that requires that it be done like a din during the day. So that's the way that the Rashbam explains what the Gemara is suggesting over here. On the other hand, the Ri and the Tosafot disagrees with the Rashbam over here. And he brings a number of questions. El Mefaresh Ri, Ora'a Kol Parsha Kulali Odin. The Inyan Shal Korcham Shal Banim Nasim Dayanim Utam Omdim Sham Vishat Zava'a. That if there are people standing there, we're going to see in a second a case like this where the three individuals that are present at the time that the person who's passing away is instructing them about what to do with his last will and testament. In that situation, the passage of the property is now done with dayanim that are there. They form a beit din automatically. That beit din, the children or the inheritors can't say, I'm not interested in that beit din. I want to go to a different beit din. I want to go to the beit din agadol. They don't have a right to do that because automatically it's changed into a din. In a situation in which the property is passed during the daytime, we're going to see, and the instructions are given in front of three during the daytime, that will automatically make them into dayanim. And the fact that they are dayanim then makes it that it is imposed upon the other parties that they are the dayanim, and they have no choice about who they choose to be the judges in this case. So the Rashbam thinks it's about division of the property. The Baalei Tosafot think about it's the composition of the beit din that's going to distribute it. On the other hand here, Ratzu Asu Din, according to the Rabbeinu Gershom, that there is considered to be a din, Shimnatan Lami Shelo Haya Ra'ui Lirish, O Sheiniach Lehen Avian Yerusha, Velo Ratza Echad Mehem Lachlok Im Echav, O Lo Natan Lebechor Pishnaim Kedin Torah, Yecholim Lasot Kedin, Kofin Oto Ad Yachlok, The Oil of the Gimel Ninu Osim Din. The Gimel Danim Dinei Mimonot. So the Rabbeinu Gershom says that the Dayanim now have a right, or the fact that it is a din is to ensure that he has acted properly in the distribution of his property, that he hasn't in any way abrogated the Torah law of Yerusha, that he's done it in a fair and appropriate manner, that he's given to those that are deserving, as well as if those that are reticent about splitting the property, to force them to split the property. And that's what he means, or thinks it means, Osim Din. And then the Gemara says, Ukid Rav Yehuda, similar to this case of Rav Yehuda, the Amar Rav Yehuda, Shlosha Shenichnesu Levaker Et HaChuleh. Three individuals went in to visit someone who was sick. Ratzu Kotvim, Ratzu Osim Din. If they want, they can document it. If they want, they can make it into a din, and they become Dayanim. Shnaim, on the other hand, if two people go in, Kotvim Ve'en Osim Din. Then they only can write it and document it. They can't make it into a din. The difference being that three can comprise a Beit Din, two can only be a Dim. So in the case where it's two, they only have one option, which is to document which they heard, because they are a Dim to the fact that this person said it. On the other hand, when it comes to three, they can choose either to be a Dim, or they can choose to be Dayanim. And based on what they do, if they're going to choose to be a Dim, they need to document it and act like a Dim. If they choose to be Dayanim, then they can adjudicate the case, they can carry out the case immediately based on the fact that they were the Dayanim who are then deciding about this case. So now, even though for the Rashbam, the case is not exactly the same, because for the Rashbam, the case of Dayanim before was the actual distribution of the Nachalot. Over here, what we're going to prove from Yehuda is the qualification of Kamei Rav Chisda, which is Lo Shanu El Beyom. That's only true during the day. Aval Belayla Afilu Shlosha Kotvim. But at night, even the three must document that which they did, and they can't act as Dayanim. So the proof to what we said before is that Nachalot involved Din. And since Nachalot involved Din, they can only be Dayanim during the daytime. And so therefore the proof from Rav Yehuda's case is that you have three Dayanim that can only be Dayanim or can be deemed Dayanim during the day, which is similar to what we said before that Nachalot involved Din. Even though the Din that we were speaking about in the previous case was the distribution of the Nachalot, nevertheless, we see that in making someone a Dayan, it can only happen during the day with regards to Nachalot. And that's the common denominator between this, or why they say Ki Da'amar Rav Yehuda. Now, the Rashbam over here makes a number of qualifications about the case here. First of all, he says it's a case of Shchiv Meira. It's someone who's on their deathbed, and then they are dictating on their deathbed that which they want to happen. Now, from this, he proves or says that you don't have to say Atem Eidai. You don't have to declare people to be their Eidim. When you're a Shiv Meira, that is assumed that their position is that of Eidim or of Dayanim. In addition, the Rashbam says over here, the case is particularly Shlosha Shenichnasu Levaker Techoleh. It's a case where these three individuals simply went in to do Bikur Cholim. If they had come in with a specific intent or purpose, for instance, they came in to be Eidim, or they came in to be Dayanim, they would no longer have a choice as to whether they are Eidim or Dayanim. They would have to do whatever they were invited to be. If the person who was there invited them to be Eidim, they can't switch over to be Dayanim, because the individual invited them for that particular purpose. He bases this off of a Gemara in Makot. In the Gemara Makot, it speaks about the fact that people or relatives that witness an event, if they witness the event with the intent to be an aid, they automatically became an aid, and they can ruin it for everyone else. So there, even though they never declared themselves an aid, but just the mere fact that they came in and witnessed it as an aid, that ruins it for everyone else, and all the Eidim become Eidim Psulim that are joined together with him. On the other hand, if they just come to witness the event, not to be Eidim, then they don't ruin it for everyone else. But what you see from that, according to the Rashbam, is that anytime someone intends to be an aid, you can't shed that shame of being an aid, and therefore you must be an aid, and you don't have a choice anymore. So those are a number of qualifications that the Rashbam makes. The Balei HaTosafot disagree with every one of them. The first one is that the Balei HaTosafot do not believe that simply being a witness to event, even if you want to be an aid, is enough to make you an aid. Because only if after they watched it or witnessed the event with the intent to be an aid, and then testified as an aid, would they become joined with the other group of individuals and ruin the Eidut. But if they never go to testify, according to the Balei HaTosafot, they don't get a Shem Eid, and they don't ruin it for the other parties. Number two is, they say it's not speaking about a Shchiv Meira. It's speaking about an individual who is a Bari. Because Shchiv Meira is only a Din Derabbanan. And over here we're speaking about a Din D'Oraita, and therefore he wants to elevate the case to a case of Din D'Oraita, and therefore he suggests that we're talking about a Matnat Bari with a Kinyan. In addition, a Shchiv Meira has a right to retract his statement. He can change it. And we don't allow a din or a beit din to sit over something that can be undermined. Over here, if the Shchiv Meira is presenting something, and then the Dayanim are going to go out and try to carry out the instructions of the Shchiv Meira, but then the Shchiv Meira could change or alter those instructions because his words are ketuvim u'b'surim dami. If he calls someone else in and changes the instructions are now undermined what he gave to Dayanim. So we won't allow Dayanim to do something in a manner that will be undermined. So some suggest over here that it's a case of a gift of a Shchiv Meira b'miktzat, which later on in the Masechta we'll see that if a Shchiv Meira gives away all of his property, then he has a right of retraction because giving away all of his property is because he assumed he was going to pass away. If he only gives away a portion of his property, then he was keeping something because he thought he might survive. In that case, whatever he gifted is a full-fledged gift and he can't retract it. That assumes that there is a kinyan. That's how the Rashbam explains it. We're talking about a Shechem Mira, they get a gift to B'miktzat, and that there was a Kinyan over here. On the other hand, the Bali et Tosafot say that we're speaking about a Bari, a totally healthy individual, who is gifting property with a formal Kinyan. And that's why it's similar to the previous case, because just like in the previous case, we said that the assignment of these individuals as Dayanim locks them in as Dayanim. That's what Rabbi Yehuda's case is saying the same thing. These three individuals who came in, and now the person is distributing property, a bari, gifting property with the kinyan. These individuals are dayanim, and the recipients have no right to question the Beit Din or the authority of the Beit Din in this case. And that's how Rabbi Yehuda is a proof to the previous situation. And therefore, the Bali Tosafot say it's not relevant whether nichnasu levakeret chole, whether they went in to visit this sick, or they came in to be edim. It's only a question if they testified as edim, that will lock them in as edim. Otherwise, they can be edim, or they can be dayanim. Number two is, we're talking about a matnat bari, and not a matnat shchiv meira. And the last thing is that the proof is from the fact that, not that we say din biyom, but rather the proof is from the fact that the dayanim are locked in this situation. And the reason that Rav Chista has to come along here and qualify the statement and say that it's only relevant during the day and not at night, even though for the Bali Tosafot it's clear that any din that deals with nachalot has to be done during the day and not at night, because that is exactly what we're speaking about, the formation of a Beit Din, then why do you need this qualification of Chista? The answer is, Vomeri, that the Perush Nami Itzrich, the Salkadato, Chemin de Mishun Mishar Dinim, because it's different than any other case, Shedanim Bal Korcho, because we impose the judges on the parties here, Havamina de Danito Afilu Belaila. Therefore, if you don't have to follow the regular protocol or process, maybe the same thing is true with regards to day or night. And that's the Chiddush of Rav Chista, that even though you can have the Dayanim be picked at Bal Korcho, still it's only adjudicated during the day, or there's only such a din or Dayanim during the day, not at night. So the Gemara says, about Belaila, Afilu Shlosha Kodvim, Eno Sim Din. My time, why at night can those three individuals only be a din and not be Dayanim? Because at night they automatically become a dim. Ve'ein eid nased dayan. And a witness can never be converted into a dayan. Amalei eino chanami ka'amino. He says, you're right, that's what I meant. I meant din nachalot, meaning the question of Abaye that he posed to Rabba Bar Chanina, Kameh de Rav Nachman. That question that he says, maybe you meant that we're talking about din nachalot. That's true, it's speaking about din nachalot. Now the way that the Rashbam explains it over here is that the ein eid nased dayan, even if a person witnessed something, they cannot become a dayan if they have to testify about that which they saw. And he brings proof from the case of Kiddush HaChodesh. By Kiddush HaChodesh, if you have a Beit Din that is walking and sees the moon, then if they see the moon during the daytime, which is unlikely, but if they witness it during the daytime, then they themselves can be the dayanim of the case, and they can be Mekadesh the Chodesh. But then, if they see it at night, they can't testify in Beit Din, or they can't testify at that point in time. Since they can't testify about that time, according to the Rashbam, they automatically become edim, because the information that they have is now something that they have to convey. And because the Pasuk says, V'amdu shnei anashim lifnei elukim, that the two people will stand before God, and over there we say it references to the edim, that the edim must stand before the dayanim, over here that's impossible, because the edim, if they become dayanim, they would testify and then sit down and be dayanim. But at the time that they're giving their testimony, they can't simultaneously be standing in front of the dayanim because they're not dayanim. So in that case, what we do is we have two of them come and testify. The third person who saw something, we have him sit down with two other dayanim. And then these two that witnessed it testify in front of the Beit Din. And that's how they're Mekadesh the Chodesh. But if they witness the event during the daytime, then they can be a Beit Din. It doesn't matter whether they're a Beit Din immediately and they adjudicate or discuss the case. They deliberate about the case right then, or they deliberated about in 3 days, because they themselves become the dayanim, and it's as if they heard the testimony themselves, because they were there and present at a time that they could be dayanim, and therefore they're acting as dayanim, and not as edim, and then they can deliberate the case whenever they want. So according to the Rashbam, the key element, or the key difference is when they witness it. If they witness the event at night, then they can't sit as dayanim immediately, and therefore by definition they become edim in the case, assuming that they are looking at it and watching it to be a deem, and therefore, when they go to testify, they have to testify as a deem, and ein eid nased dayan, which is the gzera takaduv that we spoke about before. On the other hand, if they see it during the day, since at that moment they could be dayanim, then they are as if they're hearing testimony, because the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, been speaking about Kiddush HaChodesh, says that how could it be that the Re'iyah Shalem is Pachot Mishmiyah Shalem? How could it be that they are seeing something directly is less than them hearing it directly? So if they heard it from other witnesses, then if they themselves see it, that seeing is believing, and therefore it's as if witnesses testified before them, and they, since they can carry out the din immediately, they are Dayanim immediately. But if they can't become Dayanim immediately, then they are changed into Edim because of the fact that they witnessed the event. Like the Rashbam said before, that as soon as you witness event, and you're doing it to witness the event, then you become an aid. And an aid, not said Dayan. And an aid can never be converted into a Dayan. And that's why the Beit Din, in the case of the three at night, they must write it down or testify in front of others, and they can't become Dayanim themselves. The Ramban rejects the Rashbam's view that you can compare this case to the case of Kiddush HaChodesh, because over there where the Gemara says, Shelo Teish Shmiya Gedola Miriyah, because that's the primary part of Kiddush HaChodesh, because it says, Kazerei V'Kadesh, that you see like this, and then you are Kadesh, then you're Mekadesh the Chodesh. But by Dinei Mimonot, that's not necessarily the case. There, the testimony itself is important. It's not enough that you simply see the event, and that may not be Gadol Mishmiya. And therefore, he says the reason why they are classified as Dayanim here, and you don't need a Dim, is because the instructions of the Choleh, the instructions of the individual, are the equivalent of Hodat Baldin, the admission of one of the parties. And since it's a Hodat Baldin, they harei kmei Eidim. It's the equivalent of mei Eidim. It's as if he's testifying in front of them as Dayanim. Even the Rashbam, who brings the other reason, he quotes what the Ramban says. It says, V'afagav bein kan adam shmeid bifneim klum, that the Gemara brings the quote from Kiddush HaChodesh. And then he adds on top of that, Hodat Baldin kmei Eidim dami, utzerach ma'idu Eidim bifneim. What do you need Eidim for if you already have the Hodat Baldin? So the Rashbam himself brings in that reasoning of the Ramban, even though he compares it primarily to that of Kiddush HaChodesh, he adds in the Nimuk of the Ramban also to support or bolster his position. The Ramban rejects the comparison completely to Kiddush HaChodesh and only focuses on the Odat Baldin Kamei Dim Dami. The Balei Tosafot disagree. As we said before, they think that you can't become an aid automatically. But rather, the reasoning behind Ein Aid and Nased Dayan has nothing to do with the fact that once you become an aid, you can't become a Dayan. But the Gemara gives reasons as to why an aid can't become a Dayan. Either Mishom Davya Idut Shiyata Yechol Azima, it's a testimony that can never be undermined through Edim Zomamim, that we never can perjure these Edim, because the Dayanim themselves, who were the Edim, will never allow themselves to become incriminated. O Mishom Deminim Vamdu Shnei Anashim, Elo Edim Lifnei Hashem, Elo Dayanim. Or because of the Gzeret HaKetuv that we spoke about before. Umahane Tamei, Ein lifso mitkaven la'id, ela davka adem eid ameid. For that reason, the Balei Tosafot say that only someone who testifies takes on a shem aid, and then they can never be converted into dayan. But if they never become an aid, then they can switch over and still become a dayan. So, whereas according to the Rashbam, the failure over here is that when they hear the eidut, they automatically become eidim, because they can't function as a beit din at that time. And so therefore, by definition, they are becoming Edim, and the next day when they want to deliberate about it, they're already Edim and Nased Dayan. For the Balei Tosafot, the problem is that Beit Din can't accept testimony at night. And the Tzava'ah of the Choleh is the equivalent of Kabbalat Edut. And therefore, the Kabbalat Edut can't be done at night. And for that reason, they can't function as a Beit Din, because they can only now be a witness to what he is saying. They cannot act as Dayanim to receive the testimony that he is making. And then the Balei Tosafot conclude over there that the din of Ein Aid Desei Nayan is Dafka Bidoraita. That's only in Doraita Dinim. Aval Durabanan Nase Dayan. An aid can become a Dayan in Dinei Durabanan, like Kiyum Shtarot and other Dinim Durabanan. And he has one exception to the rule where he agrees with the Rashbam that the simple witnessing of an event makes you into an aid that you can't be a Dayan, is in Dinei Nefashot. Because Afilu Eid Aruah Ein Nase Dayan Anu Dafka Bidinei Nefashot. That's only in capital crimes or capital cases, because over there, once he sees the crime that's being perpetrated in front of him, he will not be able to be melamed zchut on the individual, and therefore we disqualify him from being a dayan because of that inability to see any zchut once he's witnessed the event. And for that reason, only there where you simply witness the event can you not be a dayan. But in any other case, aid nased dayan, as long as you have yet to testify. And even in a case where you've testified by Dini Derabanan, Eid Nased Dayan, according to the Balei Tosafot. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kuf Yud Daled Amud Aleph.